Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi, fam. Welcome to the OCD Family Podcast. As we continue to appreciate our autistic loved ones here within the OCD family community and beyond. And though we've been having these conversations all month long, this week in particular has had a lot of public discourse about autism. So I'm going to take a moment with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rebecca Sachs, to affirm, to build awareness, to embrace acceptance, but to mostly appreciate autistic people.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, family. All right. Welcome back. I hope everyone is hanging in there and doing well. It is Good Friday for those whom celebrate. It is also currently Passover. It is spring and the leaves are threatening to bloom from their buds on the tree. I mean, there's been a lot going on, and yet that barely skims the surface of so much going on in our world, within conversations, within the public square, etc. So we are going to talk about how OCD and autism can show up for our warriors, for you fam, maybe your own lived experience. But I also want to address autism specifically because there has been a lot of misinformation lately in the public discourse about autism. And so I want to take a moment to reaffirm our value here in the OCD family community that autistic people are whole, valuable members of our community, OCD and beyond. Autism is a neurodevelopmental difference. It's a neurotype. So when there's conversation about autism being something to be fixed, something that is injurious, something that is destructive, that is preventable. As a mom of three autistic kids, for any newer family joining, it strikes a chord for me. So while I am not going to get into a debate, I do think this is an opportunity to stand with autistic members of the OCD family community because people are often navigating multiple layers of misunderstanding and stigma, and sometimes they don't know. I am always still learning. We all are still learning. And while I think it is good and beneficial to be curious, I think what's actually harmful or destructive is the misinformation. So I'm going to be talking with Dr. Rebecca Sachs today, the founder of CBT Spectrum, who has expertise in treating individuals with autism, anxiety, and OCD and OCD-related disorders. Rebecca is a licensed psychologist and an expert in the top recommended treatments for anxiety and OCD, and in the assessment and modification of treatment for neurodivergent individuals across the lifespan, empowering individuals and their family with knowledge and skills. And Rebecca is board certified in behavioral and cognitive psychology, and she also has a private practice in New York, as well as being the co-director of Successful School Transitions, a comprehensive program for school refusal. In addition to these roles, Rebecca is a mom to an energetic and determined second grader and a stepmom to the coolest 16-year-old around. So imagine my appreciation and gratitude when Rebecca was able to offer precious time. So thank you, Rebecca, for hopping into this conversation with me. And family, I'll just say, no matter where you're coming into this conversation from, maybe you know a lot and have learned a lot about the autistic experience of a loved one, or perhaps you're autistic yourself. Maybe you're a treatment provider, or maybe you have concerns about medication or regulation of different environmental factors. And so you come into this conversation with some pretty big feelings because of that. What I want to say is everyone is welcome in this conversation. And my goal here is not to debate. My goal here is to honor and appreciate autistic people. Our community is not one group, one type of person, one gender, one orientation, one religion, one ethnicity, one neurotype. Our community is everybody. You're part of the family. And so I will say, you don't have to agree with me, but I ask that we can have a conversation. It is a bit of a lost art, and often because we have a lot of passion and a lot of advocacy, and sometimes it's just more noise in the conversation. It's not necessarily beneficial. Sometimes it's not. I'm not sitting here trying to convince people to believe what I believe. I do have a commitment, though, to providing accurate information, support, and resources for you, for me, for the fam. And I'm unapologetic in defending my family. So we're going to have this conversation, and really appreciative of you being here. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And today, family, I am really excited to be able to have a conversation around a near and dear, integral piece of my life, a subject I talk about all the time, particularly this month. As you know, we've been talking about Autism Acceptance Month, and I have Dr. Rebecca Sachs here to help provide accurate information and really help us understand the autistic neurotype better, because there has been some misinformation in the public square. And, you know, we want to put out accurate information. And so I just want to welcome Rebecca with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad I could be here and talk about this.
Absolutely. And actually, if you wouldn't mind me asking, Rebecca, how did you get into the intersection of treating OCD and autism? I would love to hear that if you're willing to share.
Sure. Yeah. I think for some people in the professional space, it's very, very linear. I would say my journey through the people that I work with, it was not linear. It was just, I had always been interested and got training from a CBT perspective and always from anxiety and stress model and using exposure. And after graduate school and my postdoc, I really landed at a wonderful group practice down in Florida who really does quality CBT with ERP for individuals with anxiety and OCD, and got like really great training and was able to do that. And I was good at it and I enjoyed it. So I was like, I definitely want to do that. And while I was there, we had different clients who were also neurodivergent, because we know neurodivergent people experience mental health conditions probably at even higher rates than a typical population. So of course, we were going to see neurodivergent individuals with anxiety and OCD as well, and coming to the clinic for that reason. And it was NBI down in Florida, and we often worked as a team on cases. And when there were autistic clients that were coming in, I think we found, I happened to be one of the clinicians that really enjoyed the work and also seemed to click a little bit better with that work. And I had previously in graduate school had this wonderful experience for 2 summers running a component for neurodivergent kiddos at a summer camp at Berkeley, and had really enjoyed that work. That's like a whole nother podcast about that. Fast forward, trying to make a long story as short as possible. When I decided to move back to New York and hit restart on my life and looking at professional opportunities, I found this wonderful job at an autism clinic on Long Island where my entire caseload was individuals across the lifespan, anywhere from individuals with intellectual disability and not speaking to individuals with a 150 IQ and who also all had co-occurring mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. And I had some wonderful colleagues and just also some really wonderful clients and client families where I got like a crash course in autism. And then over the years, have really seen that CBT with ERP is such an effective tool for OCD, but was often being sort of withheld for autistic individuals. And just like Tylenol works on a headache, and you would never think of withholding Tylenol for an autistic individual with a headache. Yeah. Why withhold it? CBT with ERP, but realizing that it looked a little different from when I was just treating OCD to treating OCD in my autistic clients. And just with going to conferences and talking with people and working with autistic advocates and getting involved in collaboration with research is sort of like where I am today.
I love that. And I will say I've seen and heard Rebecca give amazing talks. And I was noticing even for this summer, because they just posted the schedule for the 30th annual IOCDF conference, that you're going to be presenting with our friend Dr. Jeremy Schumann, as well as Dr. Stacey Greeter, who was just on the show 2 weeks ago, where we were talking about neurodivergent affirming care.
And Evelyn Gould is also, I think.
And Evelyn Gould. Yes, absolutely. And family, what she was just speaking to in that piece of how can we modify or adapt treatment like exposure and response prevention, which is also known as ERP, one of the main treatments for OCD. Sometimes we have to, as we discussed with Stacey, we need to take a nuanced approach, and we also have to be a bit flexible and understand the person sitting in front of us. And I, to be completely honest, family, just called upon Rebecca real like in the clutch here and said, I really feel it's important for us to be able to have a conversation about autism and what autism really is. Autism is a different way of processing the world. I would love if we could talk about what is autism. And I realize that's a very big question, because if you've ever met somebody with autism, then you've met one person with autism. They're like any of us. We're snowflakes. We're unique and individual. So I would love if we could put out some accurate information and a better understanding that a disability is different than being a person that's diseased or an injured.
Yeah. We can think about like, what's the different D instead of disease? Added that for some people, it is a disability. So on a simple level, I think I can answer what is autism. Yeah. On like more nuanced, complex level, there's a lot to it. I think part of the discussion of what's even getting brought up is, well, we're often talking about OCD and anxiety disorders. We're really coming from like a medical model, right? The DSM-5, and we say, whatever phenomena is going on in describing a constellation of behaviors, we see causes a certain level of distress and a certain level of dysfunction. And from the medical model, we're saying this is a disorder and is to be treated. And it's interesting that while ADHD, while autism is in the DSM-5 and often viewed under this medical model, that it's probably not the best way to think about neurodivergence all the time, right? If we really think about what is autism, autism is part of the human condition. That is like the simplest answer that I can give. It's just maybe not the most typical or average way of experiencing the human condition, but still there's a lot of overlap with all other humans that are out there, that there is a lot of commonality. What we would say is, when we're thinking about these differences, right, these information processing differences that we see in autistic individuals, is that they tend to be centered around what traditionally has been called in the DSM-5, restrictive repetitive patterns of behavior of thinking. Mm-hmm. An alternative way, as you can say, is the conditions in which autistic people thrive is that they thrive under when there is sameness, when there is predictability, when they can do certain behaviors, especially ones that feel soothing to them. And then the other sort of part of it is, we would say, is social communication, difficulties and differences. But I think also what is probably more accurate is neurotypical social communication differences or difficulty. And so the reason why I say that is, you'll often meet individuals who are autistic who say, so much of my social difficulties or my communication differences that feel so pronounced and I have to put so much effort into it, they go away when I'm around other autistic people. Mm-hmm. Autistic people just sort of get it. I don't have to be a different way. I can just be myself. I can just communicate in my different way, and there doesn't seem to be that pressure. Now, the other piece that I would add in there, which I think goes to some of the conversation that's been in the news lately, there really is a heterogeneity to autism. And so to maybe put that in like typical people speak as opposed to psychology dork speak, is there's really a lot of difference in how we see autism presents, right? So even in those sort of two grounded commonalities, how people have social communication differences, how people do like really thrive under predictability and sameness.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really looks different from individual to individual, as well as for individuals in different contexts and across different periods of their life. One way that we often think about it is how much support does an autistic individual need in order to thrive in terms of those two different areas. But I even had a colleague of mine, Dina Gassner, who I just want to highlight. Dina Gassner and John Elder Robison, just a year ago, March 2023, wrote a really great article that said there is no epidemic of autism. It's an epidemic of need. Mm-hmm. And John Elder Robison and Dina Gassner are autistic individuals themselves and professionals and autistic advocates. And they really do a nice job in sort of laying out this idea of things. But I remember Dina said to me, she goes, you know, typically I look like level one autism, like low support needs autistic individual. I have my PhD. I'm a mom. I'm a wife, you know, speak at conferences. I am on panels, even at the UN. And there was one day she was going to present at a conference and it was in New York City and going through Times Square with all the hustle and bustle and running a little late. And by the time she sat down for lunch, she said, I probably look like I had level three autism, right? And I think we can think about it in that way, like really needing a lot of support needs, that at that moment, it was really hard to communicate and talk to the friend that she was having lunch with and, you know, feeling sort of dysregulated sensory wise and emotionally overwhelmed. And sort of thinking about it was hard to think on the spot and even think about what am I ordering for lunch in that moment and having to switch things up. And I think it's helpful when we're talking about autism to really think about variability from individual to individual, as well as within the individual in terms of these differences and how maybe sometimes the way society or a situation is structured, it can feel very disabling.
Yes, and I absolutely agree with everything you're saying. I think for so many people, when they think of autism as a spectrum, even they almost think of like a bell-shaped curve, or they think of something linear. And I know a lot of folks have found value in looking at it more of kind of a circle. But I find even adding that layer here, we're doing a podcast, so you know, sound levels go up and down, right? And it shows that we're not just at a static level. And so we need to consider for all of us, whether we're autistic or autistic, based on the kind of day I'm having, my threshold for dealing with A, B, or C is going to be different. That's not different for autistic people in the sense that they're going to be impacted by that, but it's going to look different than the way the world is set up and says, hey, this is what coping with A, B, or C should look like. And so being able to understand the needs, I love that. I love that quote of we have an epidemic of need, because that is so, so on point. And also one of the things highlighted in the public square is regressive autism.
Yeah. The interesting thing is this is where there truly is so many different ways that autism plays out or the heterogeneity in it. And realistically, it probably should be called autisms, right? Like the best information that we have, and we talk about this, is there are seem to be some genetic markers of autism. And that right now, in terms of if you want to think causality, is the strongest like correlations that we have right now. But it only explains for a certain percentage of autistic individuals. And then I think we see that there are some autistic individuals who the markers are there pretty early on and from birth, that when we think about the different behavioral things that are associated with autism, they're there. And there is a subset of autistic individuals who you see, they seem to be on the more typical developmental trajectory as opposed to a delayed or autistic developmental trajectory. And they're on this. And then we see that there is a change. And for a lot of people, it feels like an abrupt change. And right now, we don't have good explanations as to why that occurs. But to extrapolate a subset of autistic individuals and their developmental trajectory to say there must be something causal in the environment going on, when we really have no correlational data there is a bold statement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I think about it too. I have celiac, which is an autoimmune disease. I wasn't always unable to process and having my body attack itself if I was exposed to even cross-contamination of gluten. But something did activate that. And similar to autism, and I'm not trying to equate it to a disease, but what I will say is, while different environmental factors might trigger a stress response or activate or kind of turn on this gene that I had to already have genetically, that doesn't mean it's causal. It doesn't mean because I got the flu or because I got pregnant or because I was under stress that this happened. It was that this is how I was born. This is my brain. This is my body. And
it's for you to know, one of the things that they have found is mothers who have autoimmune conditions, they're more likely to see children who are autistic or neurodivergent.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about lupus, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, and things like that. Yeah. So like even just talking about it on multiple levels.
I was advanced maternal age too. And I was warned this might have some kind of impact. And I'm like, okay, yeah, it might have an impact. I'm going to have a family.
Yeah.
That's my way of looking at it. And so as we think about treatment, as we think about resources and really navigating systems of care, would you have any recommendations in terms of where we could point people to learn more accurate and inclusive and neurodivergent affirming ways to get resources and support those needs?
Oh, that's a big question. There is an autistic advocate and professor. His name is Stephen Shore. Mm-hmm. And he actually talks about like, hey, we started off with autism awareness and we've made it to autism acceptance. But like really what we need to think about is autism appreciation, right? And he talks about that third A. I might take a step back. One resource that I would just like that I think does a great job countering a lot of the misinformation is there was a journalist, Eric Garcia, and he's autistic himself, for the book We're Not Broken. And even does a very good job of talking about education and healthcare and policy gaps, as well as talked about what do we realistically know about vaccine. And so to sort of put that out there as a good resource for information is helpful. In terms of accessing care, I think part of it depends on the age of the individual and sort of what's going on. So I would encourage for the parents out there or even teenagers who are out there that if you're still in high school or below, and I would even say younger, that really getting a good diagnostic evaluation. If you don't know if someone's autistic or not, or you suspect it, is going to be very, very helpful. I am always in favor of people getting the label and as early as possible. I do think like one thing is I sometimes think people go to their pediatrician and say, you know, I'm noticing these differences. I wonder if my child's autistic and hopefully it's changing, but I still hear a lot of this sort of like watchful waiting.
Yeah.
And it runs counter to everything that we know. Like if we do want to talk about where do we have really good information and data, one place where we have really good information and data is that the earlier that we intervene for autistic individuals, the better quality of life that they have overall. So the way that we intervene is that we often get labeled, right, or a diagnosis, because that opens up the world of services and care, but just also the right sort of roadmap to go to with that label. So I would definitely encourage as early on sort of getting that answer. I think a lot of times people say, well, is it ever, you know, too early? And probably my answer would be no.
Right.
I think there's also this idea as teenagers or even young adults or late adulthood, this idea of, is it necessary? So I do think self-diagnosis is a valid form of diagnosis. Part of it is because the accessibility, both in terms of just providers that are out there, as well as cost to do evaluations, is often really, really challenging. But that if you can, and then you can also work with a professional who can sort of demystify a little bit of that, would be helpful. Becca Lori Hector recently wrote a book, Always Bring Your Sunglasses. And it's her personal story where she basically says once she got this label and this understanding of being autistic, like everything became so much more clear.
Right.
And so thinking about also that phenomena later in life, in terms of like just good information, I do like the Autistic self-advocacy network. I think like one website that you could go to for good information. I also like stands for the Association for Autism and Neurodiversity. Now, I would say probably the information, again, is going to cater a little bit more towards level one and level two autism. But I think those are two good places to start for good information. Yeah.
And if listeners, if you're like, what is level one? What is level two? What are these differences? I want you to think about it mainly in terms of the amount of support that would be beneficial to be able to access meaningful activity and functioning. And so there are a myriad of places and spaces. It feels like I see autism centers popping up all over the place, and they're not all created equal, that really live and die by the labels. What I will say is all of my kids are autistic. They got diagnosed through one of the children's specialty hospitals within the state. And they were like, we don't give labels. I know we're at time.
I have time for one more question if you want to squeeze anything in.
I mean, I feel like I could honestly talk about this forever. But what I will say is I absolutely agree that there's still a wait and see recommendation. All my kids passed the MCHAT, which was a developmental screener for autism, with their pediatricians. And I'm not shaming the pediatricians. What I'm just saying is, you know, a measure doesn't capture what we know about our own children. And if we have had the question, should they maybe be tested, then trust ourselves as parents who know our children best. And I like to describe it to whether it's friends, clients, whomever. I say it's a win-win situation to me. You either test out a question you have, a hypothesis, and you get some conclusion that says, no, actually, but maybe there is something going on. We can discover what that is and you can get support. Or you find out, yes, your child's autistic, and then it empowers you to know the ways you can best support your kid. If we were learning to ride a bike, we all have different parents and may manage things different ways, but we're probably not going to be like, well, let's just wait and see if you figure it out. You have to practice. Some people are going to have training wheels. Some people are going to do balance bikes. Some people are going to have to work on some of that gross motor coordination to be able to get to the point to pedal. But we don't just wait and see with so many things in life. We support. And this is no different. And so I would agree, it's never too late. I've worked with a number of adults that I've said to them, I wonder, have you ever been tested to see if you're autistic? Because I can't even explain how freeing it's been for people to understand that they're not this weird person they're so burnt out by life because they just don't like the temperature. They don't like the brightness. They think of things differently. They maybe communicate things differently and feel like they're wrong because that's obviously different than the way other people do it. And it's so freeing to go, actually, I wasn't wrong. I'm just different. Some people have blue eyes. Some people have brown eyes. Some people are autistic. Some people aren't. And I actually think it's a good thing if we have better understanding about autism rather than fearing, what if this is autism? What if this is autism? What if this is our brain? We all have brains that are going to brain. Be empowered to understand your brain. There's no shame in that.
Well, I don't know where I heard this from. So I'm stealing it from somebody, but I don't know who I'm stealing it from. This idea of this epidemic or being afraid, and what does this mean? You know, one of the earliest neurodivergences that was demonized, and I use that word purposely, was left-handedness, right?
I am a southpaw.
Which you even hear, like, how they used to think this was the mark of the devil if, like, you know, you were left-handed. And I even remember my grandmother, she wrote with her right hand, beautiful penmanship, but she did everything else with her left hand. She ironed with her left hand. She cut with her left hand. She sewed with her left hand. And the reason why was because she really fell into this category of left-handed neurodivergence, but she wasn't allowed. She basically had to socially camouflage and mask to meet the expectations that were met, that like left-handedness doesn't exist. And when society changed and finally said, is like, okay, it's okay to be left-handed. We're not going to force you to be right-handedness. Guess what? Skyrocketed the amount of people who are identified as left-handedness. And I think in some ways, this is where we're seeing something a little bit more along the lines of autism diagnosis. We're getting a better understanding. We're allowing people to take that label and get diagnosed. And also even sort of the traditional idea of autism, which tended to be more like a very male-centered idea and even white male-centered sort of normed testing of autism, we're seeing like a broadening. And I think there is definitely a large part of what's going on with sort of this explosion, if we want to say. The same explosion happens with left-handedness, which is a clear neurodivergence. And to think about that.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great and it's a good neutral example. And I feel like my hope is that autism can get to that space where it's a neutral example of just understanding our brain and what our brain needs. Right? Because of how the world's set up, or maybe because of just how our brain deals with different inputs, then providing it the support that it needs. There's no shame in needing support. And you still have choice. You still have choice on whether you choose that support. And so it is a conversation that is so important. And I know that you are so incredibly busy, Rebecca. So the fact that you made time to squeeze in some time at the fam, I will have to have you back and we could have that with our podcast.
Oh God, and we could talk some more with some of my wonderful colleagues that can share some of their stories firsthand.
Yes, I would love to. And thank you so much for taking the time out of your really busy schedule. And everybody listening, if you want to find out more about Dr. Rebecca Sachs, I'm going to have information links to her practice and more about her over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. But thanks again, Rebecca. This was fun. Fun is kind of a weird phrase, but I always feel energized when I can provide good, accurate, inclusive information. And thank you for being a part of that.
My pleasure.
Intrusive thoughts. Okay, family. I don't know about you, but the time really flew by for me. And again, I reached out to Rebecca yesterday because I just felt it was so important to create space for accurate information. And so thanks again, Rebecca, for being my wing person through this conversation. There's so much that could be said. And overall, I just hope that people don't fear the diagnosis, the label, the difference. I remember back before my kids were diagnosed. And as you heard Rebecca say, the earlier that you can diagnose and discover this, the better. And we know this from research based on the neuroplasticity of the brain and how it's learning and growing. And when I received some of the diagnoses for my children and disclose that to the school, because then here in the States, at least in the public school, you have to then go through an educational diagnosis. They don't take the medical diagnosis. It's a whole thing. And when I told the teachers, I have a medical diagnosis of autism, I would like to start the evaluation process or the individualized education plan process for an educational diagnosis, I heard the feedback. We kind of always suspected this. Yeah, we thought they were autistic. And family, I remember feeling angry because if you see something as an educator, if you see something as a parent, if you see something as a therapist that could help somebody not only understand their own brain, but advocate for needed and sometimes transformational supports, why wouldn't you say something? But we live in this culture where there's liability and there's fear and there's blame and there's, I don't want to be responsible because I said the quiet part out loud. And so what we miss in that is an ability to better understand and support our people. And across the spectrum, we talked about with Rebecca how even within a person, there can be variations and fluctuations in terms of the supports really needed to be able to regulate, to wind down, to rest, to focus, you name it. So here in the public square, that this neurotype is something that is destructive, less fulfilling, less productive, less capable of building meaningful relationships, engaging in meaningful activities. It breaks my heart. It's a different neurotype. It's not less than, it's not greater than, it's just different. And so for today's intrusive thought segment, if you've made it to this point in the podcast, this is my application segment of the show. And it's that time where we try to put into practice something that we've learned about or are learning about. And if you're still with me, whether you agree, whether you're concerned and skeptical, whether you're feeling really triggered, but you're here, I want to thank you because we need to have conversations. And I want to challenge you to have a dialogue. Maybe it's with your family. Maybe it's with your friends. Maybe that doesn't feel safe or comfortable. So maybe it'll be your therapist or your hairdresser or your barber or a Reddit post. But I want you to start a conversation because when we talk about autism, we're not talking about a problem to solve. We're talking about people to support. Autistic individuals aren't broken. And they don't need fixing. What they need is understanding. What they deserve is respect. And what transforms lives isn't stigma, it's support. When we can shift from seeing autism as a deficit to appreciating it as a natural way of experiencing the world, we open the door to compassion, curiosity, and connection. When we can prioritize support or needs, then we can say, you don't have to be like me for me to stand with you. Or even more, you belong here exactly as you are. So today and every day, let's commit to replacing fear with facts and replacing shame with empathy, because autistic people are not less. They are whole. They are people, and they are worthy of a world that sees and supports them fully.
Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family
like Dr. Rebecca Sachs and me loving on our autistic family.
That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery Approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.